Welcome to the Life Saving Gratitude Podcast. I'm Bunny Terry, and I'm joined by my co-host, Johanna Medina, who is also my producer. And we have a special treat for you today. Her Instagram handle is the Unreal Tanya Catan. And after talking to her, I agree. It's sort of unreal, first of all, that we got her as a podcast guest because she is sort of famous out there in the world of writers and motivators. And she wrote this great book, a bestseller called Creative Trespassing. But I got to tell you, and I'm pretty sure you'll agree with me, Johanna, this podcast was so much fun and so hilarious and so inspiring. There's a lot of laughter in this one.
Yeah, it's definitely one where I know we have a lot of serious episodes and all the episodes that make us cry, but this one was definitely one that made us laugh. And you, I mean, for sure. I mean, you have a personal relationship with Tanya, but also I know you're so excited to have her on. She's like a little celebrity for us to have on, and you're a big fan. And I am too. And it was cool to just hear her side of things and hear her talk about, you know, how she looks at her, not only her cancer diagnosis, her two diagnoses,
yes,
but also her writing and how she kind of uses creativity and how she taps into creativity. And like, there's so many different things in this episode that I think our listeners are really going to love.
Yes. And it's, you know, besides all that, besides being inspired, it's just hilarious. It was just so much fun to do. So I don't want to take a lot of time talking about it because it's so good, but I just thank you so much for tuning in, for liking us, for reviewing us, and for subscribing wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. This is so much fun. I can't wait for you to spend time with Tanya Catan and Johanna and I. I'm so excited. Does that sound a little... little dramatic? It doesn't matter because it is. Today, our guest is the fun and the funny and hilarious and like uber famous Tanya Catan. And I am so honored, first of all, to call her my friend. My friend Jock Soto brought you to a party at my house. Isn't that how it worked, Tanya? It was so cool. and then we became friends. And then she became my writing coach. And so you guys, everybody's in for a huge treat. So Tanya has this incredible background. First of all, she survived cancer twice before she was 32. And as most of you know, on this podcast, we talk a lot about survivors. So she's sort of like the coolest and she's a big deal in the survivor world. However, that's not it. I mean, she's also a best-selling author. She first wrote the book, My One Night Stand with Cancer, which is, if anybody can make cancer hilarious, it's my friend Tanya. But the other book that she just wrote is this brilliant piece called Creative Trespassing. I'm sorry, she may have written it a long time ago, but it was recently published. And it's how to put the spark and joy back into your work and life. So I want to let you know that when I met Tanya, she walked into the house, into the party, and she handed me a copy of her book. And she and her adorable, lovely, smart, artistic wife, Angela Ellsworth, said to me, "Hey, Bunny, it's nice to meet you. So sorry you're part of the club that nobody wants to be a part of." And we shared at that moment that we are all cancer survivors. But I have to tell you that Tanya took her cancer survivorship to this whole new level that's really exciting. So, and I'm going to, if you don't get to the part of the story that I love the most, I'll just prompt you along the way. But tell us, what in the world happened that you were diagnosed at such a young age? Tell that story.
I love it, Bunny. And if you noted, we came to celebrate the launch of your book about surviving colon cancer. And we left with a giant zucchini the size of a small child. So sometimes when you show up for something, some unexpected turns take place. And it was such a delight, actually. Part of what we both, Angela and I, loved about meeting you, Bunny, is not only are you a survivor, and sometimes, you know, we can't decide whether or not we survive. That's just a happy accident. I'm sure you have plenty of friends and family, as do I, who did not survive diagnoses. And so we just lucked out. And what I really loved about you initially, and that has proven to be true, is that you have this kind of zest and humor and lightness and also curiosity about life, which when you're dealing with cancer is those things are really vital, I think, to have. And that was part of my cancer story as well, which is, you know, I was diagnosed with breast cancer the first time at 21 years old. And this was in 1992, when people, you know, young women were not being diagnosed with breast cancer. And it was still like a moment of time where you'd be around the Thanksgiving table and somebody would be like, Aunt Velma has cancer, you know, like it was talked about in hushed tones. And I was just kind of coming of age. I was coming out. And here I was confronted with stage 4 breast cancer. And at the time, I was getting my degree in theater and I was focusing on playwriting. And so what I did, and the one tool that I am most grateful for in my entire existence, is creativity, and more specifically writing. And so because I was taking a playwriting class, every weird, wily thing that happened to my body as a result of being diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer, you know, I was poked and prodded and went through chemotherapy and mastectomy. Every moment that was uncomfortable and weird became a scene in my mind's eye, because I was cultivating, you know, writing for the stage. And I thought, well, if all the world's a stage and we're just players, then maybe I can approach this cancer thing as kind of recording my life in scenes as it unfolded right in front of me. And so having that creative outlet of writing really not only helped me emotionally process what was going on, but I wrote my first play called Stages when I was 21 years old and in college, and it was produced around the globe, and it was actually written up in the New York Times when I was a kid, when I was 21 years old. And I say that because cancer, it wasn't like I thought, oh, cancer's awesome, like this is gonna launch my career, you know. I thought it was horrible, and I just used creativity as a lens to process it. And then what ended up happening became a catalyst that launched my writing career. So that was the first time. And then fast forward 10 years later, you know, which in the cancer community, I realize it's a big misnomer when people are like, 10 years of cancer free, like you're done. That's the marker. Peace out. And that's not necessarily true. And so I was diagnosed with a second primary breast cancer at 31. And of course, my first thought was, well, two thoughts. One, I'm going to die. And two, if I don't die, I already wrote a play. What am I going to write? What else could I write? And so at that point, I was like, I want to write a memoir. And I'd been practicing writing personal essays. But having something as significant as another cancer diagnosis really put me into high gear of like, okay, I want to express this in a different form. And that might be a memoir or a book. But I really did, you know, when you get cancer one time and you survive, you know, it's like, woo. But when you get cancer a second time, I felt like I was like Judith Light in a Lifetime original movie, you know, like I was going to die. You know, nobody in movies gets cancer a second time and lives. And so I just was like, well, I guess I'll need to write the movie, you know, version of, and in, you know, in a memoir form of me surviving. So, you know, that's kind of the succinct version of a lot of cancer and a lot of creativity connected.
Was your play Stages, was that about cancer?
I mean, yeah, it was about, it was totally, I mean, partially autobiographical, just kidding. But, you know, like the character's name was somebody else. It was about a young woman who was 21 who was enduring breast cancer. And it was, and also 1992, she was exploring her sexuality and there was a kiss on stage and people were like all freaked out, like, oh my God, a lesbian kiss on stage, like, ew, whatever. And in fact, I had really great theatrical mentors at the time, Marshall Mason and Bill Hoffman, who were, they were creating contemporary theater in America. And they just happened to be at my school at the time and mentored me. And they're like, this is a great play and we're going to give it to our agents. And this, and I had an agent turn it down and say, this is one of the best things I've read. I would love to represent it if Tanya would consider making the characters a man and a woman, because it was too lesbian, was too radical. This agent, quote, couldn't get behind the lesbian lifestyle. And this agent today is the biggest lesbian. No, I don't know what happened. Could you imagine? And that lesbian today is Rachel Maddow. No. She would have totally got it.
She would have been like, I don't know how old she is, but Johanna,
totally wish she would have done it.
I mean, Johanna, you were too. Isn't it hard to imagine? I mean, it seems hard for me now.
No, it doesn't seem hard to imagine because it's still like that. So it's not really that hard to imagine at all.
Well, and you said, nope. I mean,
I'm still waiting for a Disney lesbian kiss. So
what?
What's a Disney lesbian kiss? I totally, that needs to be a hashtag, Disney lesbian kiss. It's when you're on the bow of a ship and some lady in coattails and black tie. I don't know. I don't know how it goes.
You can write it, Tanya.
Spiked hair. I love that idea. Yeah.
Okay.
Two
I'm
Disney
on it.
Princesses. Come out. I like that. Well, you said that creativity was your greatest. I mean, you consider that the greatest gift ever, but I mean, you were always a creative kid. I mean, did you like become creative when you got cancer? You sort of cultivated that from when you were four, you said. Yeah.
Yeah. I think poverty really helps with developing imagination. and I mean that sincerely and also jokingly, but the truth is that, you know, I grew up in poverty. And for the most part with a single mommy, although my dad is awesome in the world. But, you know, they were really like my parents early on were kind of just hustling, like had some kids and didn't really plan anything and tried to figure out the best way to raise us. And then we're divorced pretty early on. And we were just poor and scrappy and scrambling and all that. But the one thing my mom taught me early on is she basically found all of these resources for us. So to attend creative summer camps for free, like, or she would exchange her cooking skills for us to attend a really expensive camp. You know, she would teach art classes. She would get us, you know, to go to free arts and cultural festivals. So basically she showed us pretty early on that creativity had currency, and currency is what you exchange for goods, you know, and so that creativity could be a currency that we could use as well. And so, yeah, that created the foundation. And I think I was sort of born DNA style with an active imagination, and then having very little resources really nudged me to have a whole creative life. And it's really funny. I think I was just thinking about this recently. I think that the reason why I have been so sort of goal oriented and like high achieving is because I've been in shitty financial and socioeconomic situations. And so I've always had to kind of like imagine and plot a way out. And now that I'm at this point in my life, I realize like, hold up, I can actually enjoy the space in between a goal and reaching it. And so there's in the last, I'd say, 5 years of a lot of wonderful therapy and, you know, self-help on purpose, you know, seeking and good teachers, that I'm now learning how to really enjoy and enliven the middle space, which is really wonderful. So, basically my creativity helped me kind of imagine a better life than I was living. And now that I'm living a really great life, I am excited about what that creativity can do.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. Enjoying the space in between the goals. That
feels to me like the next book you should write. You know, like, I don't know. I don't know what the next book is, but I do. Oh my God, that's me. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm on Match.com waiting for that Disney kiss. That's what, isn't that the song?
Why didn't I turn?
There you go. Now you have your soundtrack too.
Goodness. I'm turning this thing off. Well, so I'm just going to tell folks, I don't know where they can find my One Night Stand with Cancer, but that's a great book. But the second book is really good. And you, the creative trespassing is, you know, like I think I told you this, you know, I read it, but, you know, it's sort of like my friend gave me this book. I should read it. You know, my friend wrote this book. I should read it. And then I went back to get ready for this podcast. And I was like, holy mackerel, this is so filled with, I mean, stuff I'm grateful for. So filled with ways to, well, give us a synopsis. I mean, I want folks to read it, but give us a synopsis of why you wrote the book and what you thought you were bringing to the table when you wrote it.
Yeah. So first of all, my One Night Stand with Cancer, the memoir, I think it's out of print, but there might be a few used copies on Amazon. Get them. I don't care if they're dog-eared and stained with coffee. And so, yeah, Creative Trespassing, it came out, Penguin Random House published it in 2019. It's still available in bookstores or Audible. Let me read you to bed. Hi, Bunny. Have a seat. No, but I did get to do it. So Creative Trespassing, first of all, the title comes from the fact that I have found myself working in situations and fields that aren't necessarily uniquely creative, or don't necessarily focus on that. And yet I've been wildly creative and wildly successful within those fields, and I'm not alone. And somebody was like, well, so what are you doing in technology? Or like, why are you working for museums? Or like, what are you doing in sales? And so I had to kind of wrap my brain about, what am I doing? It's like, well, I'm creative. And what am I doing? Well, I'm sneaking into places where I don't belong. So that's called trespassing. And then I started to learn about hundreds. And then when I speak on stage in front of, you know, thousands of people, and about bringing more creativity into less overtly creative spaces, work cultures and places, knowing that people need creativity. And once they see it, they can't live without it, right? So that's kind of the premise. And when I started speaking about creative trespassing on larger stages or companies like Expedia or Amazon or Etsy or whatever, people would come up to me almost sort of sheepishly afterwards and say, on the weekends, I play guitar, or, you know, I'm a painter. And they would start to admit what is true about all of us as humans is that we have creativity. Creativity is our DNA. And I could talk a little bit more about that from a scientific perspective. That's not boring AF. and that when they bring their creativity to this work that is seemingly like not exciting, that they actually have more fun doing it and they're more productive doing it. And so I realized this is a real thing, but nobody's written about it at all, like being the Robin Hood of creativity and also bringing ideas and resources from outside of the office or outside of your home inside. And I know the value of that from my clients and from myself kind of being a test subject in the world. So that's kind of the high level creative trespassing. And the subtitle is how to put the spark and joy back into your work and life, which I think is interesting because a lot of people are like, well, I have lost my spark and joy, at least today. I need to find a pathway to bring it back in. So it's filled with reminders and exercises as to how to do that.
Those are amazing, those exercises. But we were talking about creativity, and I, you know, the whole time you were speaking, you said, it's creativity, it's in our DNA. And you were talking, and I thought, but I think there are a lot of people, maybe you find this, Tanya, I think there are a lot of people who say, I'm not creative. I'm not creative.
Right.
I'm not
right. That. Yeah, because they're responding to, there's two kinds of creativity. We call it the big C and the little C. And by we, I mean scientists, authors, thinkers, practicers. So the big C is the one they're responding to, which is, I can't paint. How do you expect me to dance? I'm not a dancer. It's these sort of highly specialized areas. I'm not a creative writer. I can't do that, right? And that's a skill that you develop just like anyone else. The little C of creativity comes from, I think it was the early 90s, Patricia Stokes, social scientist and academic, who wanted to see what constraints would do to create creativity. Okay, so she took two groups of rodents and put them in different rooms, and they each had the same job: to push a lever. That's it. One group of rodents had both their paws. I guess they call them paws. I don't know what the hell they call rodent arms. But one group had both their front paws and they could push it. The other group had one paw behind the back or somewhere, so they could only utilize one paw, okay? The ones with two paws, like, push the lever, push the lever, push the lever. Okay, fine. The ones with one paw were like, push the lever up top, behind the back, between the legs, up high, down low. They came up with hundreds of ways to push the freaking lever. And so why that was a seminal study with creativity. And first of all, come on, we're all smarter than rodents, except for some of us. That's from Animal Farm. So what it proved was that with a constraint, you know, when we're sort of like forced to get out of our own way or thinking that we're not quote unquote creative, we can come up with infinite solutions for any problem. And so those of you who are listening right now, and you're like, I'm not creative, let me ask you this. Do you solve problems every single day? Yes. And creativity just means tapping into your innate ability to find multiple solutions for any problem. And that's why constraints are really helpful. So, you know, actually Bunny and I were talking about this the other day. Sometimes setting a timer for those who are like, I want to practice writing more, but I get overwhelmed and then I just give up. I just take my two paws and I push the lever and I peace out. you know, setting a timer for 10 minutes and writing that whole time. And you'll be like, oh my God, that yielded 5 pages, of which a paragraph is interesting, but that paragraph wouldn't have presented itself if I hadn't written those 5 pages under a 10-minute timed constraint. So yeah, everybody's creative.
I was just reminded of that because I was reminded of where I first heard that, because Natalie Goldberg says that, you know,
Writing Down the Bones.
Writing Down the Bones. She says, just start, write for 15 minutes. Don't think, let your arm go and then stop. And that was, you know, something I learned to do. I don't know when that was, 15 or 20 years ago. I don't, you know, she was brilliant because she created constraints and I had to do something with that time.
Yep.
So, and you, I think it's really funny that you say, I've had these jobs that aren't in creative endeavors. I mean, you were invited to come and work at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Scottsdale. Is that not creative? I mean, I guess that's so interesting.
Here's the underbelly, you know, this is the reality and why I thought it was so vital to write a book like Creative Trespassing for people who are embedded in companies and organizations that look like they're creative on the outside, but a lot of times thought and form, there's a disconnect. And so it's finding that alignment. What are we selling? Art. Oh, so how do we sell it? By being rigid and having rules and running a large corporately structured organization. You know, a lot of times people kind of default to, God damn those Puritans. Sorry if the Puritan community is listening right now. But, but you know, these sort of ideas of like, if we're not working hard enough, then it's not, you know, then we're not doing our job. It's just, it's a puritanical underbelly that unfortunately still exists. And the Industrial Revolution didn't help that. But anyways, I digress. So at one point I was hired at Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, which is an awesome, it's a wonderful museum and I love everyone. And still, this was years ago, but they were looking, they took a gallery space and they wanted to break the rules of of the museum. They didn't know what they wanted exactly, but they wanted someone to guide the process of maybe like drinking in that gallery, or, you know, alcohol, you know, or having live music or poetry, or stuff that you didn't do in other parts of the museum. And yeah, I got a lot. So I was hired to break the rules, basically, and not just break the rules just for the fun of it, but to invite more people in through the front doors who maybe weren't, you know, feeling like they were seen or heard or invited into a contemporary art museum. And I got, I started putting together programs and really considering who the audiences were and really excited. And I got a ton of pushback from the board, from some colleagues, and I also got support from people who understood that me running around with a video camera making silly videos about like the artists and the art wasn't necessarily, yes, it was poking fun, but really it was poking fun at the fact that, hey, we're just like anybody else at the water cooler. If you thought contemporary art was inaccessible and museums were weird and austere, we're just like you. We've got people who are rigid and shitty, and we've got visionaries, and we've got everyone in between. And so I started making a video series to expose, you know, all the wins and weirdness of working in any culture. And people started coming in through those videos to the museum. And then I made programs that were wild and like arm wrestling for art. Like my strategy for engagement was this, honestly, is A, to bring outsiders inside the museum, to bring people ideas that were somehow not considered worthy of a museum inside the museum. So arm wrestling, that's weird. That would never happen in a contemporary art museum. Let's bring it in. And then the other strategy was the opposite. How do we as a museum do give away art? Like museums are all about proprietary, keeping art, archiving it, holding it tight, never letting it go. So I created a program where we literally gave museum quality art away. So, you know, those were the strategies I'm really interested in. That goes back to early playwriting. I remember one of my assignments as an early playwright was write like a villain or like a bad character who has good qualities, or write a really lovely, loving character who has pure evil quality. So finding the inside outside, or playing with what we think of as sort of upscale and lower class, and what does it all mean if we kind of turn it on its head? And that's what I've always been really interested in.
Well, and is that part of the whole, when you suspend disbelief, I want to talk about that, because I want our listeners to suspend their own disbelief. It's so, seems like such a hard thing to do for yourself, and yet so essential.
Yeah. Well, another foundational thing I learned in theater school, and it's the principle of suspension of disbelief is that anybody who's listening right now, have you gone to the movies? Yes. I know. I hear you in my mind's eye. Have you read a book? Yes. Have you gone to a play? Yeah. Dance performance? What? Yeah. Okay. So the point is, when you suspend disbelief, you arrive at the play or at the movie theater, and you agree, there's sort of a cosmic contract that you are going to suspend all perceptions and assumptions about the world outside of the theater. You'll just leave it there. And together in the dark, you are willing to jump into an unknown world together and experience this story of the protagonist on the screen as if it's really happening, no matter if that protagonist is flying in the sky or something. We suspend disbelief so that we can dive into new worlds together. And so that's a principle for engaging in art, but it's a principle, like a founding principle for my book and practice of creative trespassing, which is, if I believed that someone with a theater degree could not work in technology, then I really limit my options, don't I? But if I suspend disbelief and I say, hey, a few of us have signed up and we believe that you can figure this out and we can take a leap of faith together and do something unknown and be okay with the results because we're curious and excited and like leap. And so that's the guiding principle for anything I do, really, is I like something challenging, something that feels weird, something that requires me to leave my assumptions and perceptions at the door in order to enter. So, yeah.
And you did that when you went to work for a tech company, right? Exosoft, what was the name? What was the name of that place?
It was called Axosoft. I don't know if they call them that anymore. It's been a long time now. There was a software company, a small one in Arizona, several years ago now, 2015, who was interested in me becoming an evangelist for them. And I thought that was a religious zealot position. And I was very excited about that. But it turns out it was just selling shit. No, in all seriousness, I had a meeting with the CEO at the time, and she tried to explain what an evangelist was ish, because she was kind of new to technology. And so we were both new to technology, yet she was the CEO of this tech company. And she's just like, you know, we've seen you around town kind of hosting these events and doing all these creative things through the museum, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. And we just think you'd be like cool to be a part of like our team and maybe this role, and we don't really know what it is and it's evolving and maybe you could evolve with it. And it was a moment where I was doing very, very well with Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. All the programs I'd launched were successful by like 5 different metrics. I was happy. There was traction with people who were coming into the museum. And so I'm like, that's the best time to leave. I love leaving when I'm ahead, because a lot of times in my 20s, I left while I was behind. And so I took a leap of faith, and so did the CEO. And we decided that even though neither of us really knew a lot about technology, we would leap into our creative skills and try to figure out what this role might be and how we might work together. And so that was kind of the beginning of the first month on the job. I was like, okay, so what am I evangelizing about? Which is really just going on stage and telling stories about the software that resonate with people emotionally and intellectually, make them buy it. And I'm like, okay, so what's this really cool software? And she's like, well, you know, it's like B2B, it's SaaS. And I was just like, what the fuck? I don't know. Can I say fuck?
Yeah.
I was like,
that's up to Johanna. I love it. So
I was like, WTF, B2B SaaS, like SaaS is what my sister has. Yeah, like B2B, like it's software as a service. Anyway, it was like, she was saying all this stuff that literally I didn't know any of the language. I didn't know what that meant, nothing. And I doubted my value at that job. And then during the second month of my job, I started learning about the software and all that kind of stuff. And then she came to my colleague, Sarah, and myself and said, we're going to host an event. It's like a girls in technology event. I want to show up in a big way. It's like, come up with ideas. And I was just like, okay. So, you know, I mean, the idea was basically we're showing up at a women in technology event, and this is 2015. And there's a pipeline issue. There aren't a lot of women in the tech space or being invited in. Women are distinctly, and non-binary folks are distinctly outsiders at this time. And so, you know, come up with an idea to what? To show that women, you know, are valuable, skilled, awesome people to be invited into this space. So at first, and this is the real deal, buddy, because I know you don't want stuff that I've said on other podcasts. The reality of the situation, I'm going to tell you the reality.
Tell us the reality.
The reality was this, is that my boss at the time was like, because we would have at this conference, it was small, like maybe there are 300 people in attendance. We'd have a little card table, 2 card tables. One would be a software developer showing, you know, with a computer showing what our software did. And on the other little card table, we could do something fun for women. So some of the ideas that were popcorned around, and I'm not saying who came up with them, cotton candy that's pink. Oh, okay. Necklaces, da da da, ba ba ba. So, you know, I mean, and let's just say, since I'm definitely I've adopted the term non-binary for myself, but before that, definitely a mannish lady, not typical in any sort of traditional puritanical lady way. And so I was just like, well, that just, you know, when we started this conversation, we were talking about alignment. You know, you were saying like, how can you work in a creative space and it's, and the output's creative and the organization's not run creatively? And so I felt kind of a disconnect between what it meant to empower women, this sort of task or this solution my boss was looking for, and cotton candy or necklaces. I just didn't understand how we could empower. So to me, my job became, well, how do we empower people to see women as, you know, and listen to women and really show women sort of a reflection, which is we are powerful superheroes. And by superheroes, I don't mean, you know, we're getting up and scaling tall buildings. I mean, sometimes we're just getting up. Sometimes, you know, like the moms who are listening, and my single mom, sometimes you're working three jobs to take care of your children and you're just making ends meet. That's a superhero. And so that became the task for me, the search for alignment with empowering women and how, what that looks like. And so anyway, and also I wanted to prove my value because I was getting paid more than in my nonprofit job. And I'm like, shit, I got to come up with a solution because you're going to fire me because I don't know what the fuck an evangelist is. Cotton candy. So I did go for a walk and I started thinking about women in the tech space and women in so many different spaces and how we're not seen, heard, or celebrated for the superheroes we are. And in my mind's eye, as I'm walking, because walking's super generative for me, and I could talk more about that later from a scientific perspective.
Yes.
And so, you know, I the symbol of the bathroom lady popped into my head. And those who are listening, you've seen her maybe a couple times today. She's got a triangle for a dress and a circle for a head, and she is everywhere in the world. That lady gets around. And I knew that she was easily recognizable across cultures and genders. And that was it. So I came back to my desk and I, with like a pen and paper, I drew her out. And I'm not a good drawer, but I could do a circle and a triangle. And I kept looking at that the shape of the dress. Like, it's a triangle. And yes, it's a dress, but other things are triangles too. And so the more I looked at it, I'm like, I convinced myself that she was wearing a cape. And then I felt like a crazy person because I was older than everyone by 5.5 years. And, you know, like that the difference between like 20s and 30s and me was like, oh my God, old lady. So I went to my colleague, Sarah, and I think she's wearing a cape. And then Sarah's like, good for you. So I printed out the women's bathroom vector and with a pen and a prayer made literally 5 lines. And then she was there. It was like, we had been looking at her back this whole time when in front she was wearing a cape. And when I showed her to Sarah, Sarah flipped out and she was like, oh, it was never a dress. And I'm like, what? And so that's, then we launched this campaign to empower women, not with cotton candy, but with capes instead. And by launch a campaign, that sounds really lofty and like there were millions of dollars put into it. It was the idea. I worked with the graphic designer to refine it, to show the bathroom symbol next to the new bathroom symbol with her cape on. And then we made stickers and I gave a talk about gender equity and parity at this conference. We handed out the stickers and within 24 hours, It Was Never Addressed campaign went viral. Every major media outlet in the world.
I saw that way before I met you. So
totally. Of course you did.
I didn't know that was you.
you know, an idea has gotten like big and bigger than you could have imagined. When I remember the first time I went through TSA, when it became like literally hundreds of millions of people know this, like, yeah. Got stickers. So I was going through the TSA and I had my little sticker on my bag, my It Was Never Addressed sticker. And the TSA agent's like, oh yeah, I have one of those. And I got one for it was like in some random city. And I, at that moment, I was like, I was so excited. And I'm like, well, you know, like I had something to do with it. And it was so big that she was just like, didn't even hear me. And at that point, which is great. And at that point, I realized, you know, the biggest ideas are the ones that people embrace as their own in the ways that they need to, you know, empower themselves and generate other ideas too. Like, so it was a really fun ride.
That is awesome. I did not know that. That's so cool.
Yep.
Well, and did, I mean, I hate to circle back, I'm not wrapping up, but you sort of did have to suspend disbelief for that to work. I mean, I, you know, it's, she was no longer just a girl wearing a dress. I hate to oversimplify, but that's.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the practice is this, the practice that anybody has access to who's listening that I've trained in, because I am a big C artist and a little C creative, is flexing your creative problem-solving muscles and taking risks to share the outcome on any scale. And that becomes easier. You know, it's like writing, Bunny, you know, when I'm sure when you were writing your book, you know, you wrote a piece and maybe you shared a little bit with someone, or you shared the fact that I have this idea or whatever. And it's scary, but you know what, what's scarier is not writing your book. What's scarier is if I had said, oh man, yeah, this might be a good idea, but I don't know, it needs to be perfect. And there are technology, this is an analog idea. Like if I kept that to myself, instead of practicing just sharing it and lowering the stakes of what could happen, what's the worst that can happen? Like, you know, nothing. I get feedback. That's it. That's, you know, that's all. So the suspension of disbelief just means showing up, practicing what you love to practice, and sharing it with people periodically on any scale, because that risk in getting it outside of your notebook or outside of your brain will yield information that will help you make it better, tinker with it, bigger, make it serve people beyond you and your notebook.
Yeah.
Well, and so I want everybody to pick up this book and read it, because those little tips, those exercises that you give, like, you know, I love the idea of having pen pals. I mean, I think it would save the world if we all had a pen pal. That's in the book. But I really wanted to read this piece on limiting beliefs, because I am the queen. I think we all are the queens of limiting beliefs. But I wanted to read this piece that you wrote because it was so true, and I want to share it. And I just want, you say in your book that limiting beliefs are the number one silent killer of creativity, more deadly than flying cockroaches, giving a speech to a crowd of thousands in your underwear, you know, the ones with the disintegrating elastic band, or running into your boss on a Saturday while high. When we cling to the belief of how things are is how they will always be, we get trapped in a mental prison of our own making. But when we believe that logic and limits are subject to change, then the world is full of possibilities. And I think that's it for, I mean, if you just put aside your limiting beliefs. I mean, Johanna posted for me just this week that I still sometimes think that I'm this chubby little farm girl from Eastern New Mexico who's not smart enough to think her way out of a box, certainly not out of the village that I grew up in. And if I still believed that, I wouldn't be here talking to Tanya Catan. So.
Well, I was going to go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say when Tanya started telling the story about switching to that job in tech, I could tell you seem like you get really energized by the challenge or, you know, it's exciting to you. And for me, I could just feel the anxiety just thinking about going to a job where they're like, well, it's a program, but you have to develop it and we don't know what it is. Like that would give me so much anxiety. I just wouldn't even do it. But now, like hearing the full story, I'm thinking, well, what if that was me? And what if I hadn't, if Tanya hadn't taken that leap, like this whole thing never would have happened. And so now I'm kind of like, all right, you just kind of got to step past the anxiety, I guess, and get out of that comfort
Johanna,
zone.
That's actually, it's really great that you said that, because you said the phrase that is the biggest gift and tool for anybody listening, which is what if. And what if is the question and tool you can have in your back pocket, and it allows for possibilities beyond this moment in time, beyond that moment when you're feeling anxiety about taking a leap into a new job or pursuing the book you've always wanted to write or getting a coach because you're ready to like explode. What if? And so it's like, well, what if I took a leap of faith and became an evangelist and decided that's just weird and I'm scared and I can quit. No big deal, right? well, what if I learned something new? What if I, so, you know, I'd encourage everybody to utilize this question when considering making move. And, you know, recently I actually did Pechakucha, or Pechakucha, as the kids say, it was in relation with Creative Santa Fe and Site Santa Fe. And so I gave this talk, and the theme was flux. And the thrust of my talk was about making change, uncertainty, and flux my co-pilots in life. And that started with cancer, because the reality, the only constant we have is change. Change is literally the only thing that exists, period. So we have a choice as to how we interact with change. Do we let it jerk us around, or like take us by the hair and just sort of swing us around the room? Or do we say, oh, change is my cope. I love change. Change is great. In fact, and when I make peace with change and I work with change and uncertainty and flux, then we become a force. Then there's acceleration. And I would say that anybody that, you know, anybody that you love or inspires or you admire has embraced change and uncertainty and flux as their co-pilots as well. It's just a practice. It's literally a practice. The more times you do something. So, yes, I love doing it. I didn't love doing challenging things when I was little. I wanted safety, comfort, and security. That's all I wanted. And so out of necessity, I had to go and do things in order to make safety, security, and, you know, happen for myself. But I didn't seek out change necessarily. But then I realized, oh, it's fun when I pick change on purpose, as opposed to it picking me when I'm, you know, so it becomes a practice for sure.
Well, and you quoted somebody else in the book that, you know, when Johanna was talking about her fears, I thought, wait, because that great quote that you quoted somebody else, that said, my value in the world is greater than my fears. And I thought, sometimes we just have to set those aside.
Yeah. That was from Stacy Kirk, who is the CEO of Quality Works Consulting Group. And Stacy and I met because we were both giving talks at a tech conference for legitimately, me illegitimately. And Stacy is that quote also not just impacted me and now you and probably thousands of other people. But we were in the space when she said that, and our the fellow speakers and attendees of this TechWell conference were just blown away, and it became kind of our mantras for the time we were there and beyond that time. So lucky all of us to learn that from Stacy Kirk.
So if there was one, I mean, I think that might've been it, but if there was one piece of the book that you would say, you got to pick this up and read it, because I have about 100. We talk to people all the time who are trying to live their life better and bigger and more creatively, and yet, you know, they're like me. We had this conversation last week. They're bogged down in change, and they feel like they're getting jerked around by it. What's the thing? What's today?
Well, I'd say that I don't have a mental Rolodex of the book anymore. I gave that up for more brain space. But I will say that two things. One, creativity is job security. And so I've really been thinking about, as I've been reflecting on this book that I wrote a couple of years ago, you know, the cool thing about creating some ideas and exercises that are expansive is that they can grow with what's happening in the world. And so I couldn't help but think of, you know, the Great Resignation. And I think everybody should be reading Creative Trespassing if they want to find meaningful work, no matter what place or space they're in. It's that you bring the meaning with you, as opposed to, you know, expect for the meaning to be there. Otherwise, I'm not gonna bring my whole self to work. That I challenge you to read the book and find the creativity that's in your DNA, that's your birthright, and bring it with you into every situation. And I dare you not to have a joyful time on this earth. I double dare you.
Well, as I said in the email I sent you, there are like 1,000 other ideas in here I want to explore. But what I really want to tell folks is that I am so grateful that I had that party and that you showed up and took home the zucchini and that I'm, you know, we're learning. I mean, I think that's some of what I got out of the book is that, man, if you're learning every day, if you're opening yourself up to creativity, if you're going for walks, which I thought was brilliant. You said that to me not long ago when I said, I cannot make myself write. You said, go for a walk, which is the answer to everything, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I said it for two reasons. Not just because it's like fun for me, which I love. Stanford actually did a study on walking, on the impact of walking and creativity. And so it really does improve your creativity. I think it's like some crazy, like by 40%. So that's why I'm a happy board member of the Museum of Walking. What's that? Oh, there'll be a link. And you'll check it out. And it changes. It basically turns the world into a museum. All you have to do is leave your home.
Well, thank you, my friend. I think I'll go for a walk now.
Yeah. Yeah. You're welcome. Thank you, Bunny.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Johanna.
That's all we've got today, friends. I want to thank you for joining the Life Saving Gratitude podcast with your host, Bunny Terry. That's me. And my producer and assistant, Johanna Medina. We feel like we're in the business of sharing the stories that save us, and we hope you'll share as well by letting your friends and family know about the podcast. Follow and like us wherever you listen, and please take the time to leave a review. Whether it's a stellar comment or a suggestion, we are open to suggestions all the time. Also, follow us on Instagram at LifeSavingGratitudePod. You can also follow me personally at Bunny Terry Santa Fe. You can sign up at my website at bunnyterry.com to receive weekly emails about how to become the ultimate gratitude nerd. Thanks so much for checking in.